Suppose, Mr. C. Does seem kinda amusing, though. And kinda cute, he allowed. Not bad duty being the father of a little guy, is it? I got no complaints, Chavez agreed, leaning his seat back now that the gear was up. How's Atari working out? Back to business, Clark decided. This grandpa stuff had its limitations. He's in better shape now. Needed about a month to get caught up. He took some razzing, but he handled it just fine. You know he's smart, good tactical instincts, considering he's a cop and not a soldier. Being a cop in Sicily isn't like walking a beat on Oxford Street in London, you know. Yeah, guess so, Chavez agreed. But on the simulator he hasn't made a single shoot-no-shoot mistake yet, and that's not bad. The only other guy who hasn't blown one is Eddie Price. The computerized training simulator back at Hereford was particularly ruthless in its presentation of possible tactical scenarios, to the point that in one, a 12-year-old picked up an AK-47 and hosed you if you didn't pay close enough attention. The other nasty one was the woman holding the baby, who just happened to pick up a pistol from a dead terrorist and turn innocently to face the incoming men of black. Ding had taken her down once, to find a Cabbage Patch doll on his desk the next morning with a packet of McDonald's ketchup spread across the face. The Rainbow Troopers had a lively, if somewhat perverse, institutional sense of humor. So, what exactly are we supposed to be doing? The old 8th Chief Directorate of the KGB, their Executive Protective Service, John explained. They've got worries about domestic terrorists. From the Chechens, I guess, and other internal nationalities who want out of the country. They want us to help train up their boys to deal with them. How good are they? Ding asked. Rainbow Six shrugged. Good question. The personnel are former KGB types, but with Spetsnaz training. So probably career people as opposed to 2-year in-and-outs in the Red Army. All probably titular commissioned officers, but with sergeant's duties. I expect they'll be smart, properly motivated, probably in decent physical shape, and they'll understand the mission. Will they be as good as they need to be? Probably not, John thought. But in a few weeks we ought to be able to point them in the right direction. So mainly we're going to be training up their instructors? Clark nodded. That's how I read it, yeah. Fair enough, Chavez agreed, as the lunch menu appeared. Why was it, he wondered, that airline food never seemed to have what you wanted? This was dinner food, not lunch food. What the hell was wrong with a cheeseburger and fries? Oh, well, at least he could have a decent beer. The one thing he'd come to love about life in the UK was the beer. There wouldn't be anything like it in Russia, he was sure. Sunrise in Beijing was as drab as the polluted air could make it, Mark Gant thought. For some reason, he'd slipped out of sync with the local time, despite the black capsule and planned sleep. He'd found himself awake just at first light, which fought through air that was as bad as Los Angeles on its worst-ever day. Certainly there was no EPA in the PRC, and this place didn't even have much in the way of automobiles yet. If that ever happened, China might solve its local population problem with mass gassing. He hadn't been around enough to recognize this as a problem of Marxist nations. But there weren't many of them left to be examples, were there? Gant had never smoked. It was a vice largely removed from the stock trading community, where the normal working stress was enough of a killer that they needed few others. And this degree of air pollution made his eyes water. He had nothing to do and lots of time in which to do it. Once awake, he was never able to escape back into sleep. So he decided to flip on his reading light and go over some documents, most of which he'd been given without any particular expectation that he would read them. The purpose of diplomacy, Commander Spock had once said on Star Trek, was to prolong a crisis. Certainly the discourse meandered enough to make the Mississippi River look like a laser beam. But like the father of waters, it eventually had to get downstream, or downhill, or wherever the hell it was that rivers went. But this morning, what had awakened him? He looked out the window, seeing the orange-pink smudge beginning to form at the horizon, backlighting the buildings. Gant found them ugly, but he knew he just wasn't used to them. The tenements of Chicago weren't exactly the Taj Mahal, and the wood-frame house of his youth wasn't Buckingham Palace. Still, the sense of differentness here was overpowering. Everywhere you looked, things seemed alien, and he wasn't cosmopolitan enough to overcome that feeling. It was like a background buzz in the Muzak, never quite there, but never gone away either. It was almost a sense of foreboding, but he shook it off. There was no reason to feel anything like that. He didn't know that he would be proven wrong very soon. Barry Wise was already up in his hotel room, with breakfast coming. The hotel was one of an American chain, and the breakfast menu approximately American as well. The local bacon would be different, but even Chinese chickens laid real eggs, he was sure. His previous day's experiment with waffles hadn't worked out very well, and Wise was a man who needed a proper breakfast to function throughout the day. Unlike most American TV correspondents/reporters, Wise looked for his own stories. His producer was a partner, not a boss handler. He credited that fact for his collection of Emmy Awards, though his wife just grumbled about dusting the damn things behind the basement bar. He needed a fresh new story for today. His American audience would be bored with another talking head plus B-roll piece on the trade negotiations. He needed some local color, he thought, something to make the American people feel as one with the Chinese people. It wasn't easy, and there'd been enough stories on Chinese restaurants, which was the only Chinese thing with which most Americans were familiar. What then? What did Americans have in common with the citizens of the People's Republic of China? Not a hell of a lot, Wise told himself, but there had to be something he could use. He stood when breakfast arrived, looking out the picture windows as the waiter wheeled the cart close to the bed. It turned out that they'd goofed on his order, ham instead of bacon, but the ham looked okay, and he went with it, tipping the waiter and sitting back down. Something, he thought, pouring his coffee, but what? He'd been through this process often enough. The writers of fiction often chided reporters for their own sort of creativity. But the process was real. Finding stuff of interest was doubly hard for reporters because, unlike novelists, they couldn't make things up. They had to use reality. And reality could be a son of a bitch, Barry Wise thought. He reached for his reading glasses in the drawer of the night table and was surprised to see... Well, it wasn't all that surprising. It was a matter of routine in any American hotel, a Bible left there by the Gideon Society. It was only here probably because the hotel was American-owned and operated, and they had a deal with the Gideon people. But what a strange place to find a Bible. The People's Republic wasn't exactly overrun with churches. Were there Christians here? Why not find out? Maybe there was a story in that. Better than nothing, anyway. With that semi-decided, he went back to breakfast. His crew would be waking up about now. He'd have his producer look around for a Christian minister, maybe even a Catholic priest. A rabbi was too much to hope for. That would mean the Israeli embassy. And that was cheating, wasn't it?
How was your day, Jack? Kathy asked.
The night was an accident. They had nothing to do, no political dinner, no speech, no reception, no play or concert at the Kennedy Center, not even an intimate party of 20 or 30 on the bedroom level of the residence portion of the White House, which Jack hated and Kathy enjoyed, because they could invite people they actually knew and liked to those, or at least people whom they wanted to meet. Jack didn't mind the parties as such, but he felt that the bedroom level of the house, as the Secret Service called it, as opposed to the other house 16 blocks down the street, was the only private space he had left. Even the place they owned at Peregrine Cliff on Chesapeake Bay had been redone by the service. Now it had fire protection sprinklers
about 70 phone lines, an alarm system like they used to protect nuclear weapon storage sites, and a new building to house the protective detail who deployed there on the weekends when the Ryans decided to see if they still had a house to retreat to when this official museum got to be too much. But tonight there was none of that. Tonight they were almost real people again. The difference was that if Jack wanted a beer or drink, he couldn't just walk to the kitchen and get it. That wasn't allowed. No, he had to order it through one of the White House ushers, who'd either take the elevator down to the basement-level kitchen or to the upstairs bar. He could, of course, have insisted and walked off to make his own, but that would have meant insulting one of the ushers. And while these men, mainly black, some said they traced their lineage back to Andrew Jackson's personal slaves, didn't mind, it seemed unnecessarily insulting to them. Ryan had never been one to have others do his work, however. Oh, sure, it was nice to have his shoes shined every night by some guy who didn't have anything else to do, and who drew a comfortable government salary to do it. But it just seemed unmanly to be fussed over as if he were some sort of nobleman, when in fact his father had been a hard-working homicide detective on the Baltimore City Police Force. And he'd needed a government scholarship, courtesy of the United States Marine Corps, to get through Boston College without having his mom take a job. Was it his working-class roots and upbringing? Probably, Ryan thought. Those roots also explained what he was doing now, sitting in an easy chair with a drink in his hand, watching TV, as though he were a normal person for a change. Kathy's life was actually the least changed in the family, except that every morning she flew to work on a Marine Corps VH-60 Black Hawk helicopter, to which the taxpayers and the media didn't object. Not after Sandbox, also known as Katie Ryan, had been attacked in her daycare center by some terrorists. The kids were off watching televisions of their own, and Kyle Daniel, known to the Secret Service as Sprite, was asleep in his crib. And so that Dr. Ryan, codename Surgeon, was sitting in her own chair in front of the TV, going over her patient notes and checking a medical journal as part of her never-ending professional education. "How are things at work, honey?" Swordsman asked Surgeon. "Pretty good, Jack. Bernie Katz has a new granddaughter. He's all bubbly about it."
"Which kid?"
"His son Mark got married 2 years ago. We went, remember?"
"That's the lawyer?"
Jack asked, remembering the ceremony in the good old days, before he'd been cursed into the presidency. "Yeah, his other son David is the doctor, up at Yale on the faculty, thoracic surgeon."
"Have I met that one?" Jack couldn't remember.
"No, he went to school out west, UCLA. She turned the page in the current New England Journal of Medicine, then decided to dog-ear it. It was an interesting piece on a new discovery in anesthesia, something worth remembering. She'd talk about it at lunch with one of the professors. It was her custom to lunch with her colleagues in different fields, to keep current on what was going on in medicine. The next big breakthrough, she thought, would be in neurology. One of her Hopkins colleagues had discovered a drug that seemed to make damaged nerve cells regrow. If it panned out, that was a Nobel Prize. It would be the ninth hanging on the trophy wall of the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. Her work with surgical lasers had won her a Lasker Public Service Award, the highest such award in American medicine. But it hadn't been fundamental enough for a trip to Stockholm. That was fine with her. Ophthalmology wasn't that sort of field, but fixing people's sight was pretty damned rewarding. Maybe the one good thing about Jack's elevation and her attendant status as First Lady was that she'd have a real shot at the directorship of the Wilmer Institute if and when Bernie Katz ever decided to hang it up. She'd still be able to practice medicine. That was something she never wanted to give up. And also be able to oversee research in her field, decide who got the grants, where the really important exploratory work was, and that, she thought, was something she might be good at. So maybe this president stuff wasn't a total loss. Her only real beef was that people expected her to dress like a supermodel, and while she had always dressed well, being a clothes horse had never appealed to her.
It was enough, she figured, to wear nice formal gowns at all the damned formal affairs she had to attend, and not get charged for it, since the gowns were all donated by the makers. As it was, Women's Wear Daily didn't like her normal choice of clothing, as though her white lab coat was a fashion statement. No, it was her uniform, like the Marines who stood at the doors to the White House, and one she wore with considerable pride. Not many women or men could claim to be at the very pinnacle of their profession. But she could. As it was, this had turned into a nice evening. She didn't even mind Jack's addiction to the History Channel, even when he grumbled at some minor mistake in one of their shows. Assuming, she chuckled to herself, that he was right and the show was wrong. Her wine glass was empty, and since she didn't have any procedures scheduled for the next day, she waved to the usher for a refill. Life could have been worse. Besides, they'd had their big scare with those damned terrorists, and with good luck and that wonderful FBI agent Andrea Price had married, they'd survived, and she didn't expect anything like that to happen again. Her own Secret Service detail was her defense against that. Her own principal agent, Roy Altman, inspired the same sort of confidence at his job that she did at hers, Kathy judged. "Here you go, Dr. Ryan," the usher said, delivering the refilled glass. "Thank you, George. How are the kids?" "My oldest just got accepted to Notre Dame," he answered proudly. "That's wonderful. What's she going to major in?" "Pre-med." Kathy looked up from her journal. "Great. If there's any way I can help her, you let me know, okay?" "Yes, ma'am, I sure will." And the nice thing, George thought, was that she wasn't kidding. The Ryans were very popular with the staff, despite their awkwardness with all the fussing. There was one other family the Ryans looked after, the widow and kids of some Air Force sergeant whose connection with the Ryans nobody seemed to understand. And Kathy had personally taken care of two kids of staff members who'd had eye problems. "What's tomorrow look like, Jack?" "Speech to the VFW convention in Atlantic City. I chop her there and back after lunch. Not a bad speech," Callie wrote for me. "She's a little weird." "She's different," the president agreed, "but she's good at what she does." "Thank God," Kathy didn't say aloud, "that I don't have to do much of that." For her, a speech was telling a patient how she was going to fix his or her eyes. "There's a new papal nuncio in Beijing," the producer said. "Well, that's an ambassador-like, isn't it?" The producer nodded. "Pretty much. Italian guy, Cardinal Renato de Milo. Old guy, don't know anything about him." "Well, maybe we can drive over and meet the guy," Barry thought as he knotted his tie. "Got an address and phone number?" "No, but our contact at the American Embassy can get him quick enough." "Give the guy a call," Wise ordered gently. He and the producer had been together for 11 years, and together they dodged bullets and won those Emmys, which wasn't bad for a couple of ex-Marine sergeants. "Right." Wise checked his watch. The timing worked just fine. He could get a report at his leisure, upload it on the satellite, and Atlanta could edit it and show it to people for breakfast in America. That would pretty much take care of his day in this heathen country. Damn, why couldn't they do trade conferences in Italy? He remembered Italian food fondly from his time in the Mediterranean Fleet Marine Force. And the Italian women. They'd like the United States Marine uniform. Well, lots of women did. One thing neither Cardinal de Milo nor Monsignor Shepka had learned to like was Chinese breakfast food, which was totally alien from anything Europeans had ever served for the early morning meal. And so Shepka fixed breakfast every morning before their Chinese staff came in. They'd do the dishes, which was enough for both churchmen. Both had already said their morning mass, which necessitated their rising before 6 every morning, rather like soldiers did, the elderly Italian had often remarked to himself. The morning paper was the International Herald Tribune, which was too American-oriented, but the world was an imperfect place. At least the paper showed the football scores, and European football was a sport of interest to both of them, and one which Shepka could still go out and play when the opportunity arose. Demilo, who'd been a pretty good midfielder in his day, had to content himself with watching and kibitzing now. The CNN crew had their own van, an American make that had been shipped into the PRC ages ago. It had its own miniature satellite transceiver rig, a small technical miracle of sorts that enabled instant contact with any place in the world via orbiting communication satellites. It could do anything but operate when the vehicle was moving, and someone was working on that feature, which would be the next major breakthrough, because then the mobile crews could work with little threat of interference from the Gomers in whatever country they happened to be operating. They also had a satellite navigation system, which was a genuine miracle that allowed them to navigate anywhere, in any city for which they had a CD-ROM map. With it, they could find any address faster than a local taxi driver. And with a cell phone, they could get the address itself, in this case from the U.S. Embassy, which had the street addresses for all foreign legations, of which the Papal Nuncio's house was just one more. The cell phone also allowed them to call ahead. The call was answered by a Chinese voice at first, then one that sounded German, of all things. But which said, sure, come on over. Barry Wise was dressed in his usual coat and tie. His neatness was another leftover from the Marines. And he knocked on the door, finding the expected local. He was tempted to call them natives, but that was too English and distantly racist, at the door to conduct them in. The first Westerner they met was clearly not a cardinal. Too young, too tall, and far too German. "Hello, I am Monsignor Shepka," the man greeted him. "Good day, I am Barry Wise of CNN." "Yes," Shepka acknowledged with a smile. "I have seen you many times on the television. What brings you here?" "We're here to cover the trade meeting between America and China, but we decided to look for other items of interest. We were surprised to see that the Vatican has a diplomatic mission here." Shepka ushered Wise into his office and motioned him to a comfortable chair. "I've been here for several months, but the Cardinal just arrived recently." "Can I meet him?" "Certainly, but His Eminence is on the phone to Rome at the moment. Do you mind waiting a few minutes?" "No problem," Wise assured him. He looked the Monsignor over. He looked athletic, tall, and very German. Wise had visited that country many times, and always felt somewhat uneasy there, as if the racism that had occasioned the Holocaust was still there somewhere, hiding close by but out of sight. In other clothing he would have taken Shepka for a soldier, even a Marine. He looked physically fit and very smart, clearly a keen observer. "What order are you in, if I may ask?" Wise said. "The Society of Jesus," Shepka replied. A Jesuit, Wise thought at once. That explained it. "From Germany?" "Correct, but I'm based in Rome now at Robert Bellarmine University, and I was asked to accompany His Eminence here because of my language skills." His English was about halfway between English and American, but not Canadian, grammatically perfect and remarkably precise in his pronunciations. "And because you're smart," Wise added to himself. He knew that the Vatican had a respected intelligence-gathering service, probably the oldest in the world. So this Monsignor was a combination diplomat and spook, Wise decided. "I won't ask how many languages you speak. I'm sure you have me beat," Wise observed. He'd never met or even heard of a dumb Jesuit. Shepka offered a friendly smile. "It is my function." Then he looked at his desk phone. The light had gone out. Shepka excused himself and headed to the inner office, then returned. "His Eminence will see you now." Wise rose and followed the German priest in. The man he saw was corpulent and clearly Italian, dressed not in priestly robes but rather a coat and trousers, with a red shirt. Or was it a vest? Underneath his Roman collar. The CNN correspondent didn't remember if the protocol was for him to kiss the man's ring, but hand-kissing wasn't his thing anyway, and so he just shook hands in the American custom.
"Welcome to our legation," Cardinal Demilo said. "You are our first American reporter."
Please. The cardinal gestured him to a chair. Thank you, Your Eminence. Wise did remember that part of the protocol.
How may we serve you this day?
Well, we're in town to cover the trade talks, America and China, and we're just looking for a story about life in Beijing. We just learned last night that the Vatican has an embassy here, and we thought we might come over to talk to you, sir.
Marvelous, DeMilo observed with a gracious, priestly smile. There are a few Christians in Beijing, though this is not exactly Rome.
Wise felt a light bulb go off.
What about Chinese Christians?
We've only met a few. We're going over to see one this afternoon, as a matter of fact, a Baptist minister named Yu.
Really?
That was a surprise.
A local Baptist?
Yes, Shepka confirmed.
Good chap. He was even educated in America at Oral Roberts University.
A Chinese citizen from Oral Roberts? Wise asked, somewhat incredulously, as the story light flashed in his head.
Yes, it is somewhat unusual, isn't it? DeMilo observed.
It was unusual enough that a Baptist and a cardinal of the Roman Catholic Church were on speaking terms, Wise thought. But to have it happen here seemed about as likely as a live dinosaur strolling up the mall in Washington. Atlanta would sure as hell like this one.
Could we go over with you? The CNN correspondent asked.
The terror began soon after she arrived at her workplace. For all the waiting and all the anticipation, it still came as a surprise, and an unwelcome one, the first twinge in her lower abdomen. The last time, now nearly 6 years before, it had presaged the birth of Julong, and been a surprise as well. But that pregnancy had been authorized, and this one was not. She'd hoped that it would begin in the morning, but on a weekend in their apartment, where she and Quan could handle things without external complications. But babies came at their own time in China, as they did elsewhere in the world, and this one would be no exception. The question was whether or not the state would allow it to take his first breath. And so the first muscle twinge, the first harbinger of the contractions of frank labor, brought with it the fear that murder would be committed, that her own body would be the scene of the crime, that she would be there to see it, to feel the baby stop moving, to feel death. The fear was the culmination of all the sleepless nights and the nightmares which had caused her to sweat in her bed for weeks. Her co-workers saw her face and wondered. A few of the women on the shop floor had guessed her secret, though they'd never discussed it with her. The miracle was that no one had informed on her, and that had been Lianhua's greatest fear of all. But that just wasn't the sort of thing one woman could do to another. Some of them, too, had given birth to daughters who had accidentally died a year or two later to satisfy their husband's desire for a male heir. That was one more aspect of life in the People's Republic that was rarely the subject of conversation, even among women in private. And so young Lianhua looked around the factory floor, feeling her muscles announce what was to come. And all she could hope was that it would stop, or delay itself. Another 5 hours, and she could pedal her bicycle home and deliver the baby there. And maybe that wasn't as good as on a weekend, but it was better than having an emergency here. Lotus Flower told herself that she had to be strong and resolute. She closed her eyes and bit her lip and tried to concentrate on her job. But the twinges soon grew into discomfort. Then would come mild pain, followed by the real contractions that would deny her the ability to stand, and then what? It was her inability to see just a few hours beyond where she stood that contorted her face worse than pain ever could. She feared death, and while that fear is known to all humans, hers was for a life still part of herself, but not really her own. She feared seeing it die, feeling an unborn soul depart. And while it would surely go back to God, that was not God's intention. She needed her spiritual counselor now. She needed her husband, Quan. She needed Reverend Yu even more. But how would she make that happen?
The camera setup went quickly. Both of the churchmen watched with interest, since neither had seen this happen before. 10 minutes later, both were disappointed with the questions. Both had seen Wise on television, and both had expected better of him. They didn't realize that the story he really wanted was a few miles and an hour or so away.
"Good," Wise said, when the vanilla questions were asked and answered.
"Can we follow you over to your friend's place?"
"Certainly," His Eminence replied, standing.
He excused himself, because even cardinals have to visit the bathroom before motoring off. At least they did at D'Amelio's age. But he reappeared and joined Franz for the walk to the car, which the Monsignor would drive, to the continuing disappointment of their own servant-slash-driver, who was, as they suspected, a stringer for the Ministry of State Security. The CNN van followed, twisting through the streets until they arrived at the modest house of the Reverend Yufa An. Parking was easy enough. The two Catholic churchmen walked to Yu's door, carrying a large package, Wise noted.
"Ah," Yu observed with a surprised smile on opening the door. "What brings you over?"
"My friend, we have a gift for you,"
His Eminence replied, holding up the package. It was clearly a large Bible, but no less pleasing for the obvious nature of the gift. Yu waved them in, then saw the Americans.
"They asked if they could join us," Monsignor Shepka explained.
"Certainly,"
Yu said at once, wondering if maybe Jerry Patterson might see the story, and even his distant friend Hosiah Jackson. But they didn't get the cameras set up before he unwrapped the package.
Yu did this at his desk, and on seeing it he looked up in considerable surprise. He'd expected a Bible, but this one must have cost hundreds of American dollars. It was an edition of the King James Version in beautifully literate Mandarin, and magnificently illustrated. Yu stood and walked around the desk to embrace his Italian colleague.
"May the Lord Jesus bless you for this, Renato," Yu said, with no small emotion.
"We both serve him as best we can. I thought of it, and it seemed something you might wish to have," D'Amelio replied, "as he might to a good parish priest in Rome. For that was what you was, wasn't it?"
"Close enough, certainly."
For his part, Barry Wise cursed that he hadn't quite gotten his camera running for that moment.
"We don't often see Catholics and Baptists this friendly," the reporter observed.
Yu handled the answer, and this time the camera was rolling.
"We are allowed to be friends.
We work for the same boss, as you say, in America."
He took D'Amelio's hand again and shook it warmly. He rarely received so sincere a gift, and it was so strange to get it here in Beijing from what some of his American colleagues called papists, and an Italian one at that. Life really did have purpose after all. Reverend Yu had sufficient faith that he rarely doubted that, but to have it confirmed from time to time was a blessing. The contractions came too fast and too hard. Lianhua withstood it as long as she could, but after an hour it felt as though someone had fired a rifle into her belly. Her knees buckled. She did her best to control it, to remain standing, but it was just too much. Her face turned pasty white, and she collapsed to the cement floor. A co-worker was there at once. A mother herself, she knew what she beheld.
"It is your time?" she asked.
"Yes,"
delivered with a gasp and a painful nod.
"Let me run and get Quan."
And she was off at once. That bit of help was when things went bad for Lotus Flower. Her supervisor noted one running employee, and then turned his head to see another prostrate one. He walked over, as one might to see what had happened after an automobile accident, more with curiosity than any particular desire to intervene.
He'd rarely taken note of Yang Lianhua. She performed her function reliably, with little need for chiding or shouting, and was popular with her co-workers. And that was all he knew about her, really, and all that he figured he needed to know. There was no blood about. She hadn't fallen from some sort of accident or mechanical malfunction. How strange. He stood over her for a few seconds, seeing that she was in some discomfort and wondering what the problem was. But he wasn't a doctor or a medic and didn't want to interfere. Oh, if she'd been bleeding, he might have tried to slap a bandage over the wound or something. But this wasn't such a situation, and so he just stood there, as he figured a manager should, showing that he was there, but not making things worse. There was a medical orderly in the first aid room 200 meters away. The other girl had probably run that way to fetch her, he thought. Lianhua's face contorted after a few minutes' relative peace, as another contraction began. He saw her eyes screw closed and her face go pale, and her breathing change to a rapid pant.
Oh, he realized. That's it.
How odd. He was supposed to know about such things, so that he could schedule substitutions on the line. Then he realized something else. This was not an authorized pregnancy. Lianhua had broken the rules, and that wasn't supposed to happen. And it could reflect badly on his department and on him as a supervisor. And he wanted to own an automobile some day. "What is happening here?" he asked her. But Yang Lianhua was in no shape to reply at the moment. The contractions were accelerating much faster than they'd done with Zhulong. Why couldn't this have waited until Saturday? She demanded of destiny. Why does God wish my child to die aborning? She did her best to pray through the pain, doing her utmost to concentrate, to entreat God for mercy and help in this time of pain and trial and terror. But all she saw around her was more cause for fear. There was no help in the face of her shop supervisor. Then she heard running feet again and looked to see Quan approaching. But before he got to her, the supervisor intercepted him. "What goes on here?" the man demanded, with all the harshness of petty authority. "Your woman makes a baby here. An unauthorized baby," the most minor of officials asked and accused in the same breath. "Juhai," he added. "Bitch." For his part, Quan wanted this baby as well. He hadn't told his wife of the fears that he'd shared with her, because he felt that it would have been unmanly. But that last statement from the shop supervisor was a little too much for a man under two kinds of simultaneous stress. Recalling his army training, Quan struck out with his fist, following his hand with an imprecation of his own. "Puck guy!" literally, fall down in the street. But in context, "Get the fuck out of my way!" The shop supervisor gashed his head when he went down, giving Quan the satisfaction of seeing an injury to avenge the insult to his wife. But he had other things to do. With the words said and the blow struck, he lifted Lianhua to her feet and supported her as best he could on the way to where their bicycles were parked. But now what to do? Like his wife, Quan had wanted this all to happen at home, where, at the worst, she could call in sick. But he had no more power to stop this process than he did to stop the world from turning on its axis. She didn't even have time or energy to curse fate. He had to deal with reality as it came, one shaky second at a time, and help his beloved wife as best he could. "You were educated in America?" Wise asked, in front of the rolling camera.
"Yes,"
Yu replied over tea.
"At Oral Roberts University in Oklahoma. My first degree was in electrical engineering. Then my divinity degree and my ordination came later."
"I see you are married,"
the reporter observed, pointing to a picture on the wall.
My wife is away in Taiwan, looking after her mother, who is sick at the moment, he explained.
So how did you two meet? Wise asked, meaning you and the cardinal.
That was Fa An's doing, the cardinal explained. It was he who came to us to extend a greeting to a newcomer in the same line of work, one could say. Demilo was tempted to say that they enjoyed drinks together, but refrained for fear of demeaning the man before his fellow Baptists, some of whom objected to alcohol in any form.
As you might imagine, there are not so many Christians in this city, and what few there are need to stick together.
Do you find it odd, a Catholic and a Baptist, to be so friendly?
Not at all, Yu replied at once. Why should it be odd? Are we not united by faith?
Demilo nodded agreement at this perfect, if unanticipated, statement of belief.
And what of your congregation? Wise asked the Chinese minister next.
The bicycle lot outside was a confused mass of metal and rubber, for few of the Chinese workers owned automobiles. But as Quan helped Lianhua to the far corner, the two of them were spotted by someone who did have access to one. He was a factory security guard who drove about the perimeter of the plant very importantly in his three-wheel motorized cart, an accessory more important to his sense of status than his uniform and badge. Like Quan, a former sergeant in the People's Liberation Army, he'd never lost his feeling of personal authority, and this communicated itself in the way he spoke to people.
"Stop!" he called from the driver's seat in his cart. "What goes on here?"
Quan turned. Lianhua had just been hit with another contraction, with buckled knees and gasping breath, and he was almost dragging her to their bikes. Suddenly he knew that this wasn't going to work. There was just no way that she could pedal her own bike. It was 11 blocks to their apartment. He could probably drag her up the 3 flights of steps, but how the hell was he going to get her to the front door?
"My wife is—she's hurt," Quan said, unwilling, afraid, to explain what the problem really was.
He knew this guard. His name was Zhou Jingjin, and he seemed a decent enough chap.
"I'm trying to get her home."
"Where do you live, comrade?" Zhou asked.
"Great Long March Apartments, number 74, Quan replied. "Can you help us?"
Zhou looked them over. The woman seemed to be in some distress. His was not a country which placed great value on personal initiative, but she was a comrade in difficulty, and there was supposed to be solidarity among the people. And their apartment was only 10 or 11 blocks, hardly 15 minutes even in this slow and awkward cart. He made his decision based on socialist worker solidarity.
"Load her on the back, comrade."
"Thank you, comrade."
And Quan got his wife there, lifted her bottom up, and set her on the rusted steel deck behind the driver's compartment. With a wave, he signaled Zhou to head west. This contraction proved a difficult one. Lianhua gasped and then cried out, to the distress of her husband, and worse, the distress of the driver, who turned and saw what ought to have been a healthy woman grasping her abdomen in great pain. It was not a pretty thing to see by any stretch of the imagination, and Zhou, having taken one leap of initiative, decided that maybe he ought to take another. The path to Great Long March Apartments led down Meishuguan Street, past the Longfu Hospital, and like most Beijing teaching hospitals, this one had a proper emergency receiving room. This woman was in distress, and she was a comrade, like himself a member of the working class, and she deserved his help. He looked back. Quan was doing his best to comfort his woman as a man should, far too busy to do much of anything as the security cart bumped along the uneven streets at 20 kilometers per hour.
Yes, Zhou decided, he had to do it.
He turned the steering tiller gently, pulled up to the loading dock designed more for delivery trucks than ambulances, and stopped. It took Kwan a few seconds to realize that they'd stopped. He looked around, ready to help his wife off the cart, until he saw that they weren't at the apartment complex. Disoriented by the previous 30 minutes of unexpected emergency and chaos, he didn't understand, didn't grasp where they were, until he saw someone in a uniform emerge from the door. She wore a white bandana hat on her head. A nurse? Were they at the hospital? No, he couldn't allow that. Young Kwan stood off the cart and turned to Zhou. He started to object that they'd come to the wrong place, that he didn't want to be here. But the hospital workers had an unaccustomed sense of industry at the moment. The emergency room was perversely idle at the moment, and a wheeled gurney emerged from the door with two men in attendance. Yang Quan tried to object, but he was merely pushed aside by the burly attendants as Lian Hua was loaded on the gurney and wheeled inside before he could do much more than flap his mouth open and closed. He took a breath and rushed in, only to be intercepted by a pair of clerks asking for the information they needed to fill out their admitting forms, stopping him dead in his tracks as surely as a man with a loaded rifle, but far more ignominiously. In the emergency room itself, a physician and a nurse watched as the orderlies loaded Lian Hua onto an examining table. It didn't take more than a few seconds for their trained eyes to make the first guess, which they shared with a look. Only a few seconds more, and her work clothes had been removed, and the pregnant belly was as obvious as a sunrise. It was similarly obvious that young Lian Hua was in frank labor, and that this was no emergency. She could be wheeled to the elevator and taken to the second floor, where there was a sizable obstetric staff. The physician, a woman, beckoned to the orderlies and told them where to move the patient. Then she walked to the phone to call upstairs and tell them that a delivery was on the way up. With that work done, the doctor went back to the physician's lounge for a smoke and a magazine. Comrade Yang, another clerk, a more senior one, said.
Yes,
the worried husband replied, still stuck in the waiting room, held prisoner by clerks. Your wife is being taken upstairs to obstetrics. But, the clerk added, there's one problem.
What is that?
Kwan asked, knowing the answer, but hoping for a miracle, and utterly trapped by the bureaucratic necessities of the moment. We have no record of your wife's pregnancy in our files. You are in our health district. We show you at number 72 Great Long March Flats, is that correct?
Yes,
that's where we live, Kwan sputtered out, trying to find a way out of this trap, but not seeing one anywhere.
Ah, the clerk nodded. I see. Thank you. I must now make a telephone call.
It was the way the last statement was delivered that frightened Kwan. Ah, yes, I have to see that the trash is removed properly. Ah, yes, the glass is broken, and I'll try to find a repairman. Ah, yes, an unauthorized pregnancy. I'll call upstairs so that they'll know to kill the baby when it crowns. Upstairs, Lian Hua could see the difference in their eyes. When Zhulong had been on his way, there had been joy and anticipation in the eyes of the nurses who oversaw her labor. You could see their eyes crinkle with smiles at the corners of their masks. But not this time. Someone had come over to where she was in labor room number 3 and said something to the nurse, and her head had turned rapidly to where Lian Hua lay, and her eyes had turned from compassionate to something else. And while Mrs. Yang didn't know what other thing it was, she knew the import. It might not be something the nurse particularly liked, but it was something she would assist in doing, because she had to. China was a place where people did the things they had to do, whether they approved it or liked it or not. Lian Hua felt the next contraction.
The baby in her uterus was trying to be born, not knowing that it was racing to its own destruction at the hands of the state. But the hospital staffers knew. Before, with Julong, they'd been close by, not quite hovering, but close enough to watch and see that things were going well. Not now. Now they withdrew, desiring not to hear the sounds of a mother struggling to bring forth death in a small package. On the first floor it was equally plain to young Quan. What came back to him now was his firstborn son, Julong, the feel of his small body in his arms, the little noises he made, the first smile, sitting up, crawling, the first step in their small apartment, the first words he'd spoken. But their little, large dragon was dead now, never to be seen again, crushed by the wheel of a passenger bus. An uncaring fate had ripped that child from his arms and cast him aside like a piece of blowing trash on the street. And now the state was going to slay his second child. And it would all happen upstairs, less than 10 meters away. And he couldn't do a thing about it. It was a feeling not unknown to citizens of the People's Republic, where rule from above was the rule. But opposed to it now was the most fundamental of human drives. The two forces battled within the mind of factory worker Yang Quan. His hands shook at his sides as his mind struggled with the dilemma. His eyes strained, staring at nothing closer than the room's wall, but straining even so. Something. There had to be something. There was a pay telephone, and he did have the proper coins, and he did remember the number. And so Yang Quan lifted the receiver and dialed the number, unable to find the ability within himself to change fate, but hoping to find that ability in another. "I'll get it," Reverend Yu said in English, rising and walking to where it was ringing. "A remarkable guy, isn't he?" Wise asked the two Catholics. "A fine man," Cardinal de Milo agreed. "A good shepherd for his flock, and that is all a man can hope to be." Monsignor Shepka's head turned when he caught the tone of Yu's voice. Something was wrong here, and by the sound, something serious. When the minister returned to the sitting room, his face told the tale. "What is amiss?" Shepka asked in his perfect Mandarin. Perhaps this was not something for the American reporters. "One of my congregation," Yu replied, as he reached for his jacket. "She is pregnant, in labor even now. But her pregnancy is unauthorized, and her husband fears the hospital will try to kill it. I must go to help."
"Franz, was gibt's ja?" de Milo asked in German.
The Jesuit then replied in Attic Greek to make damn sure the Americans wouldn't get it.
"You've been told about this, Eminence," Monsignor Shepka explained in the language of Aristotle. "The abortionists here commit what is virtually murder in any civilized country in the world, and the decision to do so in this case is purely political and ideological. You wishes to go and help the parents prevent this vile act."
Demilo needed less than a second. He stood and turned his head.
"Fa'an?"
"Yes, Renato."
"May we come with you and assist? Perhaps our diplomatic status will have practical value," His Eminence said, in badly accented but comprehensible Mandarin.
It didn't take long for Reverend Yu either.
"Yes, a fine idea. Renato, I cannot allow this child to die."
If the desire to procreate is the most fundamental known to mankind, then there are few more powerful calls to action for an adult than child in danger. For this, men race into burning buildings and jump into rivers. For this now, three clergymen would go to a community hospital to challenge the power of the world's most populous nation. "What's happening?" Wise asked, surprised by the sudden shifts in language and the way the three churchmen had leapt to their feet.
"A pastoral emergency. A member of Yu's congregation is in the hospital. She needs him, and we will go with our friend to assist in his pastoral duties," de Milo said.
The cameras were still running, but this was the sort of thing that got edited out. But what the hell, Wise thought. Is it far? Can we help? Want us to run you over? Yu thought it over and quickly decided that he couldn't make his bike go as fast as the American news van.
That is very kind, yes.
Well, let's go then. Wise stood and motioned to the door. His crew broke down their gear in a matter of seconds and beat them all out the door. Longfu Hospital turned out to be less than 2 miles away, facing a north-south street. It was, Wise thought, a place designed by a blind architect, so lacking in aesthetic as to be a definite government-owned building even in this country. The communists had probably killed off anyone with a sense of style back in 1950 or so, and no one had attempted to take his place. Like most reporters, the CNN team came in the front door in the manner of a police SWAT team. The cameraman's tool was up on his shoulder, with the sound man beside him, Barry Wise and the producer trailing while they looked for good establishing shots. To call the lobby dreary was generous. A Mississippi State prison had a better atmosphere than this, to which was added the disinfectant smell that makes dogs cringe in the vet's office and made kids hug your neck harder for fear of the coming needle. For his part, Barry Wise was unnaturally alert. He called it his Marine training, though he'd never seen combat operations. But one January night in Baghdad, he'd started looking out the windows 40 minutes before the first bombs had fallen from the stealth fighters, and kept looking until what U.S. Air Force planners had called the AT&T building took the first spectacular hit. He took the producer's arm and told him to keep his head up. The other ex-Marine nodded agreement. For him, it was the suddenly grim looks on the faces of the three clergymen, who'd been so genial until the phone had rung. For that old Italian guy to look this way, it had to be something, they both were sure. And whatever it was, it wouldn't be pleasant. And that often made for a good news story. And they were only seconds from their satellite uplink. Like hunters hearing the first rustle of leaves in the forest, the four CNN men looked alertly for the game and the shot.
"Reverend Yu," Young Kwan called, walking, almost running to where they were. "Eminence, this is my parishioner, Mr. Young."
"Buongiorno," DeMilo said in polite greeting. He looked over to see the newsies taking their pictures and keeping out of the way, more politely than he'd expected them to do. While Yu spoke with Young, he walked over to Barry Wise to explain the situation.
"You are right to observe that relations between the Catholics and the Baptists are not always as friendly as they ought to be. But on this issue we stand as one. Upstairs, the officials of this government wish to kill a human baby. Yu wants to save that child. Franz and I will try to help."
"This could get messy, sir," Wise warned. "The security personnel in this country can play rough. I've seen it before." DeMilo was not an imposing man in physical terms. He was short and a good 30 pounds overweight, the American figured. His hair was thinning. His skin was sagging with age. He probably went out of breath going up 2 flights of stairs. But for all that, the Cardinal summoned what manhood he had and transformed himself before the American's eyes. The genial smile and gentle disposition evaporated like steam in cold air. Now he looked more like a general on a battlefield.
"The life of an innocent child is at risk, Signore Wise," was all DeMilo said, and it was all he had to say. The Cardinal walked back to his Chinese colleague.
"Get that?" Wise asked his cameraman, Pete Nichols.
"Fucking A, Barry," the guy said behind his eyepiece.
Yang pointed. Yu headed that way. DeMilo and Shepka followed. At the reception desk, the head clerk lifted a phone and made a call. The CNN crew followed the others into the stairwell and headed up to the second floor. If anything, the obstetrics and gynecology floor was even more drab than the first. They heard the shouts, cries, and moans of women in labor.
because in China the public health system did not waste drugs on women giving birth. Wise caught up to see that Yang guy, the father of the baby, standing still in the corridor, trying to identify the cries of his own wife from all the others. Evidently he failed. Then he walked to the nurse's desk. Wise didn't need to understand Chinese to get what the exchange was all about. Yang was supported by Reverend Yu and demanded to know where his wife was. The head nurse asked what the hell they were doing here, and told them all that they had to leave at once. Yang, his back straight with dignity and fear, refused and repeated his question. Again the head nurse told him to get lost. Then Yang seriously broke the rules by reaching across the high countertop and grabbing the nurse. You could see it in her eyes. It shocked her at a very fundamental level that anyone could defy her state-issued authority so blatantly. She tried to back away, but his grip was too strong, and for the first time she saw that his eyes were no longer a display of fear. Now they showed pure killing rage, because for Yang, human instincts had cast aside all the societal conditioning he'd absorbed in his 36 years. His wife and child were in danger, and for them, right here and right now, he'd face a fire-breathing dragon barehanded and be damned to the consequences. The nurse took the easy way out and pointed to the left. Yang headed that way, you and the other two clergy with him, and the CNN crew trailing. The nurse felt her neck and coughed to get her breath back, still too surprised to be fearful, trying to understand how and why her orders had been disregarded. Yang Lianhua was in labor room number 3. The walls were of yellow glazed brick, the floor tile of some color that had been overcome by years of use, and was now a brown-gray. For Lotus Flower, it had been a nightmare without end. Alone, all alone in this institution of life and death, she'd felt the contraction strengthen and merge into one continuous strain of her abdominal muscles, forcing her unborn child down the birth canal, toward a world that didn't want it. She'd seen that in the nurses' faces, the sorrow and resignation, what they must have seen and felt elsewhere in the hospital when death came to take a patient. They'd all learned to accept it as inevitable, and they tried to step away from it, because what had to be done was so contrary to all human instincts that the only way they could be there and see it happen was to be somewhere else. Even that didn't work. And though they scarcely admitted it even to one another, they'd go home from work and lie in their beds and weep bitterly at what they as women had to do to newborns. Some would cradle the dead children who never were, who never got to take that first life-affirming breath, trying to show womanly gentleness to someone who would never know about it, except perhaps the spirits of the murdered babies who might have lingered close by. Others went the other way, tossing them into bins like the trash the state said they were. But even they never joked about it, in fact, never talked about it, except perhaps to note it had to be done, or maybe, there's a woman in number 4 who needs the shot. Lianhua felt the sensations, but worse, knew the thoughts, and her mind cried out to God for mercy. Was it so wrong to be a mother? Even if she attended a Christian church? Was it so wrong to have a second child to replace the first that fate had ripped from her arms? Why did the state deny to her the blessing of motherhood? Was there no way out? She hadn't killed the first child, as many Chinese families did. She hadn't murdered her little large dragon with his sparkling black eyes and comical laugh and grasping little hands. Some other force had taken that away from her. And she needed another. Just one other. She wasn't being greedy. She didn't want to raise 2 more children, only one. Only one to suckle at her breasts and smile at her in the mornings. She needed that. She worked hard for the state, asked little in return, but she didn't ask for this. It was her right as a human being, wasn't it? But now she knew only despair. She tried to reverse the contractions to stop the delivery from happening,
but she might as well have tried to stop the tide with a shovel. Her little one was coming out. She could feel it. She could see the knowledge of it in the face of the delivery nurse. She checked her watch and leaned out of the room, waving her arm just as Lien Hua fought the urge to push and complete the process, and so offer up her child to death. She fought, controlled her breathing, struggled with her muscles, panted instead of breathing deeply, fought and fought and fought. But it was all for nothing. She knew that now. Her husband was nowhere near to protect her. He'd been man enough to put her here, but not enough to protect her and his own child from what was happening now. With despair came relaxation. It was time. She recognized the feeling from before. She could not fight anymore. It was time to surrender. The doctor saw the nurse wave. This one was a man. It was easier on the men, and so they gave most of the shots in this hospital. He took the 50cc syringe from stores and then went to the medication closet, unlocking it and withdrawing the big bottle of formaldehyde. He filled the syringe, not bothering to tap out the bubbles, because the purpose of this injection was to kill, and any special care was superfluous. He walked down the corridor toward labor number 3. He'd been on duty for 9 hours that day. He'd performed a difficult and successful cesarean section a few hours before. And now he'd end his working day with this. He didn't like it. He did it because it was his job, part of the state's policy. The foolish woman having a baby without permission. It really was her fault, wasn't it? She knew what the rules were. Everyone did. It was impossible not to know. But she'd broken the rules, and she wouldn't be punished for it. Not really her. She wouldn't go to prison or lose her job or suffer a monetary fine. She'd just get to go home with her uterus the way it had been 9 months before. Empty. She'd be a little older and a little wiser, and know that if this happened again, it was a lot better to have the abortion done in the second or third month, before you got too attached to the damn thing. Damn sure it was a lot more comfortable than going through a whole labor for nothing. That was sad, but there was much sadness in life, and for this part of it, they'd all volunteered. The doctor had chosen to become a doctor, and the woman in number 3 had chosen to become pregnant. He came into number 3 wearing his mask because he didn't want to give the woman any infection. That was why he used a clean syringe in case he should slip and stick her by mistake. So. He sat on the usual stool that obstetricians used both for delivering babies and for aborting the late-term ones. The procedure they used in America was a little more pleasant. Just poke into the baby's skull, suck the brains out, crush the skull, and deliver the package with a lot less trouble than a full-term fetus. And a lot easier on the woman. He wondered what the story was on this one, but there was no sense in knowing, was there? No sense knowing that which you can't change. So. He looked. She was fully dilated and effaced, and yes, there was the head. Hairy little thing. Better give her another minute or two, so that after he did his duty, she could expel the fetus in one push and be done with it. Then she could go off and cry for a while and start getting over it. He was concentrating a little too much to note the commotion in the corridor outside the labor room. Yang pushed the door open himself. And there it all was, for all of them to see. Lien Hua was on the delivery table. Quan had never seen one of them before. And the way it held a woman's legs up and apart, it looked for all the world like a device to make women easier to rape. His wife's head was back and down, not up and looking to see her child born, and then he saw why. There was the doctor, was he? And in his hand a large needle full of... They were in time.